Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crimes to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
Susan, we have a very important show tonight. We're going to be talking about abusive relationships and actually surviving an abusive relationship. But before we get into that, we see time and again in the news tragedies ending relationships who didn't have the battlefield in their own home and didn't get out of it alive. And a couple of people I'd like to mention here, three in fact, who are still missing and yet to be found, are Kelly Rothwell, a police cadet in Florida who vanished on March 12, 2011. Jackie Waller from Cape Girardeau, Missouri, never seen again after entering her estranged husband's residence on June 1, 2011. And Gail McCaffrey, after a family dinner, and the last person known to have seen her alive on March 17th was her husband, Robert, who was recently named a suspect from Charleston, South Carolina. And then, of course, we have Stacy Peterson, who's been missing since October 28, 2007. And each of these women are casualties of a war that they fought in their own homes.
And they lost that battle. And I think that's what's so important. We need to look at this, as you and I have talked about time and time again, is the battle within the home that is not looked as a battle because it's behind closed doors and it's against the law and it's an epidemic. More women have lost their lives than all of the wars combined, Vietnam, Afghanistan, in this country than those who have lost their lives to intimate partner homicide. So it's important.
And joining us for tonight's show are two women who are alive today because they planned ahead for safety from their abuse. Barbara Fiorucci and Tracy Murphy are going to share with us the importance of surviving violence in the relationship by using the evidentiary abuse affidavit. Each of them is out of the abuse and into making plans for the future. Barbara and Tracy, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Let's start with the senior, Denny. Let's start with Barbara. You know, why don't you tell our listeners how you were married for 30 years.
I'm sorry,
Barbara?
Susan, I didn't hear you. Yes, I couldn't hear
you. You were married for 30 years. And
yes.
So when you met Prince Charming, what was the relationship like at the beginning?
At the beginning, it was magical. He was amazingly caring, charismatic, interested in me, just wanting to please me all the time. Within 3 weeks of us meeting, he proposed marriage to me. I had been waiting for a guy like that all my life.
Why? Because he proposed marriage to you?
Yeah, and because he was just, on paper, he was amazing. He had everything that I wanted. He was a father, a divorced father of two little boys. He's a wonderful dad. He was wonderful with his family. He had friends who loved him. He just looked really great on paper. And it was just a magical thing. It was a dream come true. And he said to me when we were getting ready to get married and I was nervous about it, he said, "Step out in faith. I will always be here to support you." And honestly, that was the first time in my life that I believed somebody would be there to support me, my husband. And I did step out in faith, and I got married to him. And the first year was really fabulous. I got pregnant with my first daughter, and we were so happy. And I thought everything was great. And then slowly I started to realize there was something missing. And what it ended up being was intimacy. I started to notice other couples and how they related to each other and didn't really understand why we didn't have that connection. And, of course, I blame myself. I grew up in a family that was disconnected, a family that showed no support for each other, a family that showed no nurturing.
Do you think that has a lot to do with it?
It had everything to do with it. I was trained to be the wife of the man that I married because everything that he was, I knew instinctively to be normal for me. Self-absorption, manipulation, raging, everything that he was in our home, my parents were at home, and it felt normal. It felt fine until it didn't.
Hold on a minute. Denny, when you hear this, what do you think?
Well, I'm thinking what we've heard many times about the initial courtship, if you will, of starting what turns out to be an abusive relationship, where the guy comes across as a Prince Charming type of character, you know, somebody like Barbara said that she'd been waiting for all her life. And here this guy comes in more or less on his white horse, sweeps her off her feet, tells her what she wants to hear. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, apparently, that it was a kind of a big con.
Yeah.
Christy Murphy, why don't you tell us, you know, you have had your share of relationships. And the last one, very violent, that almost cost you your life. It also cost you hospital injuries. And when you met this person, because you'd already been divorced once, you meet this person, and what is so different about him that you start dating, and on paper, as Barbara says, that you decide, you know what, I just head over heels over this guy?
Well, I think that after my relationship with my kid's father, I think I maybe felt worthless about myself or didn't feel that, you know, I don't know what I thought, but when this person approached me, who was extremely charming and charismatic and you know, had the nice car and wanted to sweep me off my feet and take over, you know, everything, I'm just thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, someone really cares about me. So I fell into it, and I thought it was just wonderful. And I thought it was wonderful that he wanted to take control of the situation and you know, then, you know, later, you know, as things unfolded, the truth really came out.
So was it a rescue? Do you think it was a rescue of the storybooks that we were as kids? You know,
oh, yeah.
That someday my prince is going to come and he's there and that's what you want to see?
I think so. I think that he sure painted a really nice picture for me, and it was exactly what I would ever want in a relationship, and I bought into it. I believed it. And
looking back on it now, do you see that it really, you had rose-colored glasses on, that you really weren't seeing him for what he was, because he was a bad boy and yet wonderful, and he gave you what you wanted and controlled it by
kind
of pulling it back.
Well, to a degree, and then if I was overly confident, or he didn't want me having any sort of feeling of power or control, he had to have it all. So it wasn't until later when I started realizing that I wasn't seeing my friends and my family as much, that everything that he would say about friends and family was discouraging for me to. And, you know, it took a long time for me to, I mean, I really don't even think I understood until after, you know, the relationship. But I was scared because he was very intimidating and threatening. And even though
you're
a
man, you're hearing this, and, you know, both these women, they meet Prince Charming. I know for a fact. You've been married for a long time to a wonderful woman. you would never allow that. And how hard is it for you? And you're, you know, former law enforcement. So how hard is it for you to hear? This goes on every day. This is not just Barbara and Tracy. For you to hear that this is the normal in this world today.
It's very, to me, I find it actually frightening that this occurs, this type of situation, as often as it does. And obviously there are a lot of the guys out there, a lot of the men out there, excuse me, are con artists, if you will. They're able to put on an air when they're trying to impress what turns out to be their victim, you know, through the dating, courting process until they develop that relationship. And Susan, I know I have, and I'm sure, excuse me, you have heard some of the scenarios where these guys eventually then get control. They take control of, and it may sound nice to begin with, oh, somebody's going to take care of me. I don't have anything to worry about. They're going to do everything for me. They're going to help me with this, do that. But they end up taking control. And I know I've talked to some women, and I suspect you have too, who they became so beholden to this and so dependent on an individual that eventually when they realized things weren't going that well, they almost couldn't make a move. I mean, they were trapped. And and it really is scary, and it's the other thing that frustrates me, and I'd like to ask each of the guests in a minute about this, is I hear on occasion in these situations where after the truth, the reality sets in of what the situation is, that later on then some people will approach the, I'm going to call it the victim, the wife or the girlfriend, and say, oh, my God, you know, I've known about this guy for years. He's been violent. He's been this. He's been that. And I've often wondered where these people are when they could do some good, if they could. Of course, I realize that when you got emotional, you know, romantic tie-ups, so some people don't want to hear things like that. But it's a shame when you got guys with track records going back quite a ways about that type of behavior, and yet they still are able to manipulate and get the other, get additional victims, as I'm calling them, down the road. I get very frustrated because it seems as though there's got to be a way somehow that this doesn't happen. We got two ladies tonight who were very fortunate to, you know, not to be in that first list I read of the people who are missing. And but obviously, as we've been talking about, not everyone gets out in one piece, and it's just a shame. I don't know what can be done about it for sure, but there's got to be a way.
Denny, can I speak to that for a minute? When I met my husband, his wife had, 2 years before I met him, literally disappeared on him, taken his children, taken his furniture, and literally dropped out of sight for 4 months. And it took me 30 years until I was actually sitting in the lawyer's office making plans to divorce him that I realized, oh, my God. That's why she
That's
did
why.
I get it now, and it's exactly what I'm going to do. And it was I never once realized it until then.
Oh, I have goosebumps over that. But that's exactly that, just that chill that I have right now. I can identify with it, and that's exactly how I felt. And once I realized, and I thought, oh my gosh, then the question is, how do you get out?
Exactly.
Then you go, okay, I can't just get up and leave, and I can't tell this person.
And I can't talk to him because anything could happen if I try to bring this up with him.
Is it embarrassing to talk to people? I mean, so many lives have been lost. Is it become still so embarrassing to admit that you need help, support, that you're in an ugly relationship?
For me, it wasn't that. For me, it was dangerous because it was a small town. He knew everybody in the town. And so whoever I told, they didn't believe me. And he would somehow turn it around to make it look like it was me. And
Tracy Murphy, you keep a journal, and there's different dates and times. And this one goes back to August 1st of 2009. It continues, I will not change unless action is taken to change destructive patterns. I can't change him. I continue with my counseling, therapy, group meetings. I love them. I feel growth every day. Each feeling of stepping forward, I can't read that, is empowerment, which when I feel good inside, my choices are mine and I take accountability for them. I involve myself wrongly and I know it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to that point where you wrongly knew, oh my gosh.
About the eighth time I went back to him. I went back to him the eighth time or so, and I was with him for 2 months or so. And I believe that was summertime that I wrote that.
It was. It was August.
Okay, yeah. Oh, so August. That was right before I left.
But you say in your notes, I can't explain it yet why I went back. I suppose so many reasons.
Yeah.
As I evaluate each reason, I realized it's not worth it. I am sacrificing myself, my worth, my happiness, my well-being. I actually believe I could handle the toxicity while I had redefined myself. Again, I was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in your journal entries, your journal entries are telling. I mean, you tell yourself. You write all this out.
That's right. That's right. And then what was the date on that? Did you say August what?
It was the first week in August sometime. I already passed it up.
Okay. Well, what's interesting is I left him. I finally escaped and got away from him on August 21st that month. So, yeah, that was right at the tail end when I was thinking, okay, you're going to get away this time. You're going to make it happen.
Because he tells you he's going to kill me. And you know this. So why do you go back?
What did I go back for?
Yeah.
He was able to contact me. And when he was able to contact me, he was able to go on with the whole, I'm sorry, I love yous, and why don't you just come for a visit, and that kind of a thing. And then I went for the visit, and then I stayed, and then I stayed a little bit longer, and then next thing you know, I was in it.
Okay.
And that's why no contact is the most important thing. Absolutely no contact whatsoever.
I was going to say, and what's interesting about that is how he went about finding me, because I had already relocated, I had already changed my phone number, and what he did is he found somebody that I knew, and he told that person that I knew that he has a check for me or something like that.
And that would make you react.
And I did. I somehow bit on that little thing, and that was it. Yeah, that's how it started.
Yeah. For you, Barbara, you were concerned about your children. You were concerned about you. They were the center stage, and you created the facade.
Yes,
And you're a mental health professional who counsels people, who treats them, who's respected in the community where you live and in your career, and so you're doing this dance. And it was you called it a pinwheeling. Dipping, driving, soothing, running as fast as you could, determined to make us love each other, be close to your connection. You did your very best to keep your husband happy and your children safe. You were determined that your family would be perfect. What else could I do? Turns out what I could do was extremely dangerous, and it was. And you, how did you cope? Here you are treating everybody else to the outside world. You're building this loving, bonding relationship with your daughters, but your husband is teeter-totters on narcissistic, psychopathic, and it escalates, every year. It becomes worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're living in, are you living in a secret of fear? Are you afraid people are going to find out? How do you realize that the environment that you're in, and you have the means to leave? You're not someone who, you can just go, but you've got your children. But it's your life that's so important, and you know that the children are going to be held hostage if you don't do everything you can to outsmart him.
Yes, definitely. And it took me a long time to wake up, Susan. I mean, I numbed myself out for years with binging and starving and reading and exercising and all the things that I did to, and just running around like a maniac trying to keep myself so busy that I was never home for more than 2 seconds at a time.
What do you mean starving?
Starving being anorexic. I was anorexic. I was bulimic. I was exercise bulimic. I was just numbing myself, self-medicating, trying to keep my head above water because I blame myself for everything that was going wrong in my family, and I felt no power to change any of it. I felt like I had made my bed and I had to lie in it.
So what did you see when you looked in the mirror yourself? Did you look at yourself and say, I'm attractive, I'm worthy, I'm pretty, or that I'm worthless, I'm no good, and nobody will ever want me?
Right.
Honestly, Susan, I could not look at myself in the mirror for 30 years. I could not look at my face in the mirror. I couldn't see my eyes in the mirror. I just couldn't. I couldn't face myself. I felt like a total failure. I felt like a failure as a kid, and I felt like a failure as a wife. My kids were really, they were my saving grace, and actually were the ones who woke me up to the fact that my marriage was really bad and had been for a long time. And so they were the ones, Denny, who actually said, this guy's been bad for you for years. My own children, his own children.
Huh. Can I ask a question? I'd like to ask it of both. I'll start with you, Barbara, if it's okay.
Sure.
You and Tracy, I believe, were in the same boat in the sense that you both thought you were doing the right thing at the time. I mean, the guy spun his magic and everything, like you say, on paper looked wonderful. But I'm just curious, did any family or friends or anything, did they sense any red flags, or did anybody try to tell you, say, are you sure you want to do this or something like that? Or was everybody, including your social circle, did everybody think this was the right thing to do?
Nobody ever said anything to me, including my parents. And it wasn't until, and I never spoke with my parents about what was going on in my relationship until I was getting ready to get out last year in October. And my father said to me, I always knew this was happening. But he had never, ever come to me and said, are you being abused? What's going on? I don't feel right about this. He never said one word, no.
Nobody and how about you, Tracy? Did anybody try to give you any heads up?
No. None whatsoever, and I did not stop. I was looking for help. I was asking, and I would, I was just exhausting myself trying to find answers because I didn't, at that point, I didn't understand what domestic violence was, and I used to run around just thinking, how he's treating me has just got to be against the law, and then, called the police about it, and they really didn't want to, help me too much, so No, and my family,
But your therapist, you're both seeing therapists. What the hell is wrong with them?
Oh, the therapist, yeah. I started seeing my therapist when I left him, and then I went back to him. And then, of course, he discounted my therapist, told me I'm going to the wrong kind of person, and I believed him. Yeah, and then I wasn't satisfied with that because I wasn't happy. So then I luckily found in a small little town, it was called Dove, and it was a domestic violence organization. And I found that place, started therapy there, and that's where I developed, creating my safety plan. And thank goodness this lady was able to, sit there with me. And while I made the phone calls and just, figure out what my plan was going to be, she let me sit in her office and do that. But not a lot of guidance. No guidance. But
no.
While the abuse was going on, I didn't even have friends that would say, this isn't right. This isn't acceptable. You shouldn't.
They wouldn't say that to you? They didn't say that, or they did?
No, I never heard any of that from anybody.
No.
I remember when, you reached to a whole bunch of people, including myself, Tracy, and, I wound up sending you the evidence. I wound up sending you the Times Up book and the email. And Denny, it was kind of kind of funny because Tracy kept getting a hold of me and saying, I need to talk to you. I went, no, because it's what I call the vomit stage. Whereas when someone is so toxic that they're not going to listen to anything that they need therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're only going to hear what they want to hear, so it's a waste of my time. That they need to follow the prescription in the Time's Up book.
Well,
and I know that...
That's right. That's exactly what it was, Susan. And really, I was just searching for help. I was looking for an education. I was looking for knowledge. And you did. You provided me that book, and that was what I needed. And it was...
But I made you do it. I just said I wasn't going to speak to you unless
mm-hmm.
you... I said, everything's in there. This is what you have to do. And that,
yeah.
Denny,
it was funny.
It was funny, kind of comical, how she kept finding ways because she was used to dealing with somebody that was so manipulative. And I don't mean this in a bad way, but that she had learned this behavior, so she was trying to get my attention by doing all kinds of things.
I can imagine.
And I understood it. And it wouldn't be for a year and a half later before I finally spoke with you. Because by that time, I knew you had done everything. You had gotten... How long did it take you to get the restraining order against him? The permanent one?
I got that in 2009. I got that in November of 2009. But he doesn't pay attention to a restraining order. He could care less if there's a restraining order. He manipulated the judge and had somebody else fill out his forms. It was a joke. So that's what was more scary than anything, is that he has no regard for the law.
No.
So on that note, I had to really cover all my bases and make sure that he couldn't do that little manipulative tactic and try to locate me like he did before and go, you know, there was a time where he was going through my kids' friends. And having them contact my kids.
Talk about your injuries that are probably never going to go away with your back and things.
Oh, my spinal cord injury? That's from one of the times when he was in a rage, came over to my house and broke all the doors and the locks and kicked in everything as he was storming through the house and chased up the stairs. And I ran into the bathroom. Shut the door, and I was hiding, you know, behind the shower curtain. Not that that's going to do much, but I didn't have any other place to go. And he kicked in the door, and the mirror on the back of the door shot across the room, and it stabbed me in the back. Well, unfortunately, the stab wound healed on the outside, but did not heal on the inside, and I was not aware. Sadly, he also raped me at the time, and I got pregnant, and I needed to have an abortion, and I wasn't going to have a baby with this man. And so I chose to have this medical abortion, and somehow I had an adverse reaction to it, which gave me a sepsis infection, blood infection, that went through my body and into the stab wound area that hadn't healed properly, and I developed a 5-inch abscess in the epidural fluid of my spinal cord. And that went misdiagnosed for 6 weeks, and I couldn't walk. I was completely paralyzed. And even then, my friends, they'd come over. You know, it was a pretty shady community where I lived at the time. And they'd come over, and I don't know if they were coming over to really see how I was doing or if they were coming over to rip me off. But needless to say, I didn't get anybody to help me get to the hospital until a friend finally came up, found me practically dead, unconscious, and took me to the hospital, and that's when they found this abscess. And now forever I will have this injury.
So he forever, besides, you know, moving forward, everything you walk with the pain, and you're still going for trying to get surgeries, trying to get this corrected,
yeah.
It's forever. Barbara, when you leave in 2010, you fail the first time. Why?
Yes, I failed the first time. I left in January, and the minute I left, he called my cell phone, and I picked it up. He told
me
his heart was breaking.
Why did you pick it up?
Because I just couldn't not pick it up. I just had to hear what he had to say, and he told me his heart was breaking, and how could I do this? We were best friends. We've been married for 30 years. You know, how could I walk away from this relationship that's we've been together for so long and had such a history together. And I talked to my girls. I talked to my dad. Everybody said, don't go back, don't go back. And I said, I'm just going to go back, and I'm just going to chat with him. They were afraid for me to go into the house alone with him.
Why?
But I
Why
did.
Were they afraid?
I think they were afraid that he may have a – he had guns. They were afraid that he may be laying in wait for me with a gun. They didn't know what was going to happen. They thought if maybe we got in another argument, he'd be putting his hands on me. But my attitude was always, I can handle this. I handled it my whole life, and I thought I could handle him, I mean, for 30 years. And so I went back, and we talked. And my main thing was I just wanted us to finally be able to talk about anything. He never would talk about anything. We never solved any of our problems together.
Why would you want to talk with someone who was so violent and destructive and dangerous? What's that going to solve?
I just thought that he was going to. I thought he was going to finally hear what I had to say. Yeah, I really did.
And then he would magically snap his fingers and he's going to change.
Yeah, I did.
Because he was the father of your children.
Yeah, and because he was the love of my life, and because he was my Prince Charming, and even though things had been so bad, I just couldn't believe he didn't love me, and I just couldn't believe he was doing all of this to hurt me. I just felt like he just didn't understand where I was coming from, and if I could just explain, he would understand and love me again. I really believe that he could change. Yeah. I don't
and
know.
And so,
yeah,
do you go back after you plan and leave like that? In 2010, so you go back with him and you think, okay, is he nice to you when you're back?
Literally within a week, we went right back to the problems we were having, even shorter
right.
than a week. And on top of the problems we were having, he was then accusing me of getting ready to leave him again, and I could leave him at any time, and how could he trust me? My attitude
yeah.
was, I could have left you any time for 30 years. You know, why is this suddenly a problem? I said, look, I came back. I'm here. I want to work this out. And it just really, really disintegrated and went downhill fast. And so I left again in November. And this time I followed times up and I did it right and got out and have been gone for almost 7 months.
What did you do that was right?
What did I do that was right?
That you didn't do the first time. What did you do that besides you didn't pick up the
biggest
phone?
The biggest thing that I didn't do the first time was get rid of my phone. The second time, I got a track phone, which does not have a GPS on it,
and
deleted all of my contacts on my regular phone and left the phone at the house when I left. I left my phone there, and I took my track phone with me with a new phone number. The second thing that I did right the second time was I told people. I had only told my daughters the first time and my dad, and I was really alone. When I left, I was terrified and alone. This time I actually confided in three or four of my friends who were amazing and got me out. I had kept secrets my whole life and really was taught never to talk about what happened in the house out in public. So I was really isolated and did not reach out to anybody until the second time. That was really
great. The second time,
great.
How long of time? Because it's not overnight. So how long of time do you start to plan before you are going to leave this time correctly?
I started to plan in the middle of October, and I left on November 6th. But I had already learned a lot of lessons from the first time when I went back. And I applied all of those lessons to this time and did it right.
So the first time was your dress rehearsal?
Yeah. I didn't realize it, but it was a dress rehearsal. And once we got back together and I saw that things were getting bad, it was in my mind for months. And slowly but surely, I accepted it, and slowly but surely, I realized that I really had to go. And then I finally did.
Yeah.
But it wasn't easy. I mean, yeah.
I'd like to ask you a question, if I could. I think it was Barbara a little bit ago was mentioning that she blamed herself for a lot of the problems and so on and so forth and couldn't look in the mirror and this kind of thing. Do you find in your work that a lack of self-esteem or lack of confidence, that type of thing, is common, fairly common with victims of domestic violence?
It's like wearing a pair of extra high pumps with another set of heels. It's part of them. And then they can't get the shoes off because they fit so snugly. And it becomes a part of them, you know, like an extra skin. And so they don't have any self-worth. They feel that their identity is wrapped up in the relationship, all the love that they have, that they find. They're willing to forgive this person at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
And for dangerous, abusive behavior, one minute it's, I love you, baby, and the next minute it's, I am so angry and disappointed and upset with you. How could you do this? I'm not going to talk to you anymore. You've disappointed me. And then it escalates into worse, which is the violence, the beatings. And sometimes the words can be just as,
yeah,
as hurtful as the beatings themselves. It's how they look at you, how they speak to you. And so for people involved in these relationships, be it a man or a woman, they have no self-esteem. They don't think that they're worth it. And I always, and I've said this for a long time, because I've been doing this since, what, 1990, is that when the offender says, you're worthless, you're no good, well, does anybody stop and think, Denny, well, if I'm worthless and no good, why are you with me?
What does that make you?
What does that make you, Bozo? You know, why don't we think like that? Why are we always saying, well, what did she do? And that's part of it. So her self-esteem is always tied to society. Society's views, society's non-acceptance that this is a crime, that she may have done something to make it happen, set it off. It's behind closed doors so nobody sees. There is a man right now in, I want to say, California. He is away. Safeway Stores just let him go, and they have to go through the grievance policy. He was the butcher. He stepped in between a five-month-old pregnant woman in the Safeway store and her boyfriend, who physically assaulted the pregnant lady. And he was relieved from his duties of the job pending what the store is going to do or the policy of Safeway. Now, if somebody steps in public and steps to the aid of someone, because it's against the law, and in California they have the toughest laws, and the police department, Denny, there, is behind this guy. I mean, they want to give him an award. They're raising money for him. He's about to have a baby himself. And he loses his job for helping somebody? Talk about slap in the face to aid someone, and not only the woman, but her unborn baby. And so there's been this big uproar, there's been this big petition to get him his job back, because Safeway just said, well, it's their policy. Are they crazy? How many women shop at that store? So I say to everybody, you need to be boycotting Safeway until they get this matter resolved, because he came to this aid of this woman. It's no different to me than driving in the car and saying to somebody who's drunk, I need to take your keys away. Are you going to lose your job for that, Denny?
You shouldn't.
No. So we have a skewed system in this country. We treat victims as though they are the criminal on the stand when they're being raped, on the stand. We rape them with questions. We make them feel as though it's happened again. We've allowed the defense and the justice system to really re-victimize victims across the country. So you can see why, yeah, there's no self-esteem, but there's also no place for them to go.
No.
Because
right.
There's no supportive system. You shelters, a lot of times, are overcrowded. There's a lot of issues. Time's Up was created so that would be the prescription, not a diagnosis, that it would take you through all the steps of being 10 steps ahead of him with what you had to do, follow the plan, and then do the evidentiary abuse David and video, not the other way around. This isn't lip service. I'm proud of the fact that nobody has died in all of the years that I have done this work. No one. And that has come to me. There are, in the cases that we read about, the Stacys, the Kellys, you know, the Jackies, those are the cases that I deal with, and they're alive because of the work that I did. And so that Time's Up is 20 years of work of what works, what you have to do.
Susan, don't you think, and this is an observation, a conclusion really I've come to, I'll like to hear comments on it, that, and I have known in the past, you know, spoken with a woman or two who's been in abusive situations, and the answers are, well, yeah, we're having tough times right now, but I can ditch this guy anytime I want. And I think if a woman is actually thinking that way, they're going to be in for a rude awakening, because we've been discussing tonight, you got to have a plan. I mean, you can't just, you know, one night say, well, I don't like, you know, he slapped me up or was verbally abusive or whatever, so tonight's the night I'm going to take off. You got to have somewhere to go, know where you're going to go,
right.
Have arrangements made. I mean, you know, so I think any woman who thinks that all they like, you know, I can quit smoking whenever I want to, right. I think if they're in that type of situation, it's critical, obviously, and Susan, I'm sure you agree with me, they got to think it through.
Remove the emotional, Jenny, because it takes it to their knee. That somehow, when they are with this person, the emotional feeling, that love that they remember of the person, as both these women said that at the beginning of their relationship, they looked good on paper, they were everything that they wanted. That's all they remember is that person. So
right.
That person has been long gone, long dead. And for a woman, it seems, who's been so toxic in this relationship, she truly loved him so much that even years later, I'm guilty of that. That because you made a promise to go forward and have a relationship with this person, and you still think, you know, gosh, I miss him. But what do you really miss? You only miss the beginning of that courtship, of the bond that you formulated at the beginning, that hypnotic state that you were in when you were dating, and then when you said, I do, or when you had kids, that was everything. And you didn't want to fail at it, because we think that failing in a relationship is a reflection on us. I don't think that way. As I always say, you know, how many times do I changed husbands like you change your underwear? It's because they made a promise to be a certain way and to do certain things. And when they didn't, I wasn't going to stand around and at a certain point be cornered. And I know that the first time when I was married to someone, the mistake that I made was that my mother was my life. And I ended the marriage because I had to keep her alive, and I knew that. And that was probably the dumbest mistake I did, because I would have still been married to that person, whom I'm still in contact with. But, you know, it was what was best for her, but I couldn't tell him things because, here, in the relationship, when he met my father and my mother and they had come to the house, he said to me, and I didn't disclose anything to him, I didn't disclose about my parents, he said, your dad doesn't seem bad. Why didn't you, I want to go fishing with him, I want to go to the trainings with him, I want to hang out with him. Why did it take you so long to have him over to the house for dinner? And then he said, whatever happened when you were a kid, it can't be that bad. Get over it. You're a big girl now, and let's have a relationship with your dad. And I wanted to vomit, because I only had him over for dinner because my mother had asked me. She said, please make peace and have us to your home. I didn't want to do it. But here is someone from the outside saying to me, because I couldn't tell him how bad it was. I couldn't tell him that my father, I always felt my father was going to kill my mother until when he did. I couldn't tell him certain things because I was not believed as a child that my father was beating my mother, that I was punished for saying that this was going on. So I wasn't going to tell the person that I was married to. Instead, I divorced him because he didn't understand. And he thought I was making too much of it until he came to my parents' funeral. He didn't know. You know, and was that my fault? Probably, but there were so many secrets that had to be carried. So I think, Denny, too, it's the secrets. So for Barbara, she grew up in a house where there were secrets, where everybody kept everything, and she was working hard to fix this house, like Humpty in a way, that just you couldn't put it back together again, right, Barbara?
No, right, exactly. I couldn't put it back together. I didn't realize that it was out of my control. I didn't realize I blamed myself, and I thought I was the only one that could fix it. When I finally realized about the pathology, thanks to Sandra Brown and you, I started to realize that he was never going to change. And
talk about pathology a minute, Barbara.
Yeah. What pathology?
Talk about it.
He could never the biggest thing with him is he always had to be right. He was inane and nonsensical, but he was right. There was nobody that was ever right. There was nobody could ever tell him what to do. There was nobody could make a suggestion or discuss anything with him. He was a raging lunatic. Did things his way. You couldn't question him. If you questioned him, he would either get violent or threaten to leave. He was off. He could go from laughing to suddenly yelling and screaming at you and getting out of his chair and running after you in seconds. And if he drank, it was worse.